2 weeks ago, we focused on the turn, on how God prepares us and lets us turn to the Lord. Last week, we focused on how God beckons us and makes us right so that we can truly come and see God. We are changed if we open ourselves up to God, but the change does not stop at this point. The change does not stop in an instant. Forrest, if you could show the first map. So this is a map of Israel in the ancient days. It's kind of blurry, but you can see there's the Dead Sea and the Jordan River, and up the top is the Sea of Galilee. And at the very top of the Sea of Galilee is this place called Capernaum. It's right at the top, and it's this really interesting, Sea of Galilee is this geographical marvel in that the feeding river comes directly from the north and goes directly from the south. And it's really hilly and mountainous on all sides. So there weren't really many villages on the shores except for the north and the south where the river comes in. And so that's where Jesus goes, and he goes to this little village of Capernaum. If you visit today, there is an archaeological site with all these ruins and this church, which kind of sits there. When I first saw it, I thought it was like a flying saucer. It kind of stands out. It was originally built for a visit from the Pope in the 60s, and it is because it is built directly over the place where we believe Peter, his home was. And so for Catholics, the Pope being the heir of Peter, the See of Peter, and so when Pope, I think it was Paul VI, said a mass on this church, and it's clear on the bottom, it's transparent glass, and so you can look down into the house, into Peter's house. When I first visited a few years ago, I went with Alina, and I just thought, this is so strange to see among these ancient ruins, like all this concrete, to see, what is, it's so bizarre. It was the only time I ever went to the Holy Land was with Alina. Alina grew up there much of her time and has family there. And so when we went and visited, we didn't go with a tour guide. We went with cousins. It was really lovely. And the unique thing about it is they had been all their lives there and hadn't visited like the Christian holy sites. Because it wasn't, they were Jewish, mostly secular Jews, but it just wasn't a part of their world. And so we went to Capernaum. We went to the site of the Sermon on the Mount that I'll talk about next week. But when we went here, Alina's cousin Gabby, who's finishing up a postdoc in like climate science, is this really brilliant lady. And we went into the church, and I thought like, oh, look at, you know, I was just like kind of poo-pooing the architecture and how dated it seemed and all of this. And she thought it was lovely. She thought it was the most beautiful church she'd ever been into because of all the light everywhere. The glass all around, there's clear glass on the ceiling. It was so bright. And it just seemed so holy. And what to me seemed like 1960s architecture run amok, to her was beautiful. It seemed so strange to me, but I think the strangeness leans to its beauty. The strangeness of the church among the ruins. That's what I want us to hold on to as we come to the text for today. This is a strange thing that is going on. This is not normal. It is not a normal occurrence. And so I want to read part of the passage today, and I want it to be strange for you. This kind of thing doesn't normally happen. People don't usually walk up to others doing things and they just drop everything and follow them. That is not something that we should expect to happen. As Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And then, as he went from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. And in the boat there was their father, Zebedee, mending their nets, and he called them. And immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. So we have four big steps in this. First, Jesus sees the disciples. They don't see him, Right? Jesus sees the disciples and goes to them. And in this action, Jesus sees them and judges them worthy. He judges them worthy of participating with him in this movement. And all of the justification, all of justification is found in this one moment. Jesus sees Simon and Andrew and he judges them worthy of a call, or else he would have just kept on walking. You can just keep on walking around the lake. That's what lakes are. Next, he asks them to lay down their nets, which in fact is asking them to put down who they are and who they have been. He asks them to put down their identity. He asks them to put down their livelihood. No longer will they fish for themselves, but for all people. For I will make you fishers of men. That's how the King James translates it. It is hard for me to get away from it. I love the phrasing of it. It's very elegant. The New Revised Standard Version, which is the one we usually use and is often very good, is very clunky in this and says, like, I will make you fish for people. Which I think is a good sentiment, but it's just not good English. But for a long time, I didn't understand what this meant. And I mean this seriously. I didn't understand this passage. I thought it was so beautiful. I thought it was the heart of discipleship. But I misunderstood what was going on. And the way I thought you disciples, you Peter, and you used to cast your nets and catch fish. But now you're going to cast your nets and catch people. This is, in fact, the same misunderstanding that undergirds most bad evangelism. That we wince from. We see and interact with folk who take the skills and talents of a used car salesman and puts it to the gospel. We see the bait and switch. We see, you know, good cop, bad cop, bandwagon effect. All these things, all these tricks to try and deceive people into doing something. Because it's this catching, you're trying to catch them. Right? Because the disciples are the ones who are going to be catching people. That's what I thought. That's how I interpreted it. But no, that is not what is going on. That is not what Jesus means. And I'm yelling to myself more than to you because I was so foolish to not try and think deeply about this incredibly deep passage about what is going on here. Okay, so we have the disciples in Capernaum, and this, you know, the sea is on the other side, and they're in their homes, and they're fishing, and there's two men fishing with a net, probably a little bigger than this one, but not much bigger. And so with, you know, that kind of net, you can't really feed a lot of people. They weren't fishing, they weren't making a lot of money from their livelihood. This wasn't like Bubbacum Shrimp Co., where they're like, it just keeps on coming and coming, and they can have franchises and franchises and franchises. They are just getting by. They are fishing, they are fishermen, and they fish to feed themselves, and maybe a little bit extra, but that is the point. And so Jesus comes to them, and they are fishing to survive. And they are fishing for themselves. By saying, I will make you fishers of men, Jesus is telling the brothers that no longer will they simply work to feed themselves, but truly to feed all people. To feed all people. That is the shift. They're not going to catch people. They're going to give them the food of heaven. They're going to give them life. And even in the Greek, it's kai poeso humos haleis anthropon. And so anthropon is human, anthropology, anthropon. And it is a genitive. It is possessive. And so when the NRSV translates fish for people, and I understand what it's trying to do to avoid the gendered language, but the ambiguity it adds to the text avoids what's really going on. The point is not the fishing, the point is the people. And it's to feed them. And that is the transformation. Jesus isn't taking a bunch of fishermen and letting them translate their skills at fishing into other human endeavors. Jesus is taking these people and asking them to drop who they are, that God will give them the power, the strength, the confidence, the will to feed all people. Yet nevertheless, this is a strange thing to say, and it should seem strange to us, a strange claim to make, and an even stranger one to accept. Simon and Andrew miraculously accept John's call. James and John accept, Jesus' call. They lay down their nets immediately. They lay down their nets and follow him. And this following him, this is what we call sanctifying grace. This is sanctification, which is another way of saying being made holy, being set apart for the work of God, which is love, being set apart for friendship with God, being set apart with God to feed the world the spiritual food they need to survive. Sanctification is being made holy for a purpose. Follow me is the call to discipleship. But sometimes we can go along with the flow, go along with being a Christian without putting down our nets. We can go along without turning to God. And this is what Dietrich Bonhoeffer would call the gospel of cheap grace. And I want to read a little passage from his book, The Cost of Discipleship, which some of you may have read before. It was one of his only texts that was published before he was arrested. Been thinking a lot about him recently. So this is what he says. Cheap grace is the mortal enemy of the church. Our struggle today is for costly grace. Cheap grace means grace as bargain basement goods. Cut-rate forgiveness, cut-rate comfort, cut-rate sacrament. Grace as the church's inexhaustible pantry from which it is doled out by careless hands without hesitation. It is grace without a price, without costs. Cheap grace means justification of sin, but not of the sinner, because grace alone does everything. Everything stays in its old ways. The world remains the world, and we remain sinners. Thus, the Christian should live the same way the world does. That's the heart of it, that grace is cheap if after receiving it, you're the same person and you do the same way. You don't have this transformation. So the Christian need not follow Christ. You don't need to do anything with cheap grace. You don't need to change anything. Everything you're already doing is great. Cheap grace is preaching forgiveness without repentance. It is baptism without the discipline of community. It is the Lord's Supper without confession. It is absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without the living incarnate Jesus Christ. Okay, now here we get to the good stuff. Costly grace is the hidden treasure in the field, for the sake of which people go and sell with joy, everything they have. It is the call of Jesus Christ which causes a disciple to leave his nets and to follow him. Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again, the gift which has to be asked for, the door at which one has to knock. It is costly because it calls us to discipleship. It is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly because it costs people their lives. It is grace because it thereby makes them live. It is costly because it condemns sin. It is grace because it justifies the sinner. Above all, grace is costly because it was costly to God. Because it cost God the life of God's Son. And because nothing can be cheap to us, which is costly to God. Above all, it is grace because the life of God's Son was not too costly for God to give in order to make us live. God did indeed give up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God. Grace is costly because it forces people under the yoke of following Jesus Christ. But it is grace when Jesus says, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." Costly grace. The grace of laying down the nets. It cost them something. They gave up something to follow Jesus. Jesus didn't say, "Oh, just keep on doing what you're doing and everything will be great." He had something more for them. And it wasn't like, give up what you're doing and experience all these privations and hurt. It was, you're feeding yourself. Now you can feed others. Follow me. And Simon and Andrew are not called as individuals. James and John are not called as individuals. They are called together. They are brothers. They're called as brothers, and they follow Jesus as brothers. This is so central to everything about who Jesus is and what is going on. Jesus doesn't just imprint a new ethical code on our lives so that we can be holier than thou and can hold ourselves up against other people. Jesus takes us out of living for ourselves so that we can, with others, live for others. The with others part is essential. Follow me is not a lonely call. It is a communal call. Jesus doesn't come to the disciples individually. He comes to them together and calls them together, and they come together. And it can feel lonely when you're thinking about the things you leave behind. Yet God does not call us to leave behind what is life-giving. God calls us to leave behind what is isolating, what is limiting, what is self-destructive. When we ever give up something for God, it is always and everywhere a something we do not need. God does not ask us to give up love. God does not ask us to give up joy or beauty or mercy. God asks us to give up pride. God asks us to give up laziness and lust. And the steps we take to follow God are not steps we take alone, but they are unfamiliar. They are strange. They are new, and so they are heavier. And the steps of costly grace are unfamiliar. Outside of God revealing God's self to us, outside of Jesus Christ, they are frightening. This fear, though, is not found in God. This fear is found in what we cling to. The heavy steps of worry. Of worry if this is the right thing. Of worry of what we need to do. Weigh us down. But the path lightens as we walk it together. As we walk it with church. As we walk it with God. The path lightens with consistent worship. With prayer. With prayer together. With prayer like on Wednesday afternoons in our prayer group at 4 p.m. With prayer together. The steps lighten. With studying the scriptures together. The path lightens with the works of mercy and the works of piety, with the means of grace. The joy of Christ fills the space where worry held supreme. The joy of Christ is not naive. It doesn't ignore the brokenness of the world. It doesn't ignore bad things that are happening around. As Henry Nouwen writes, people who have come to know the joy of God do not deny the darkness, but they choose not to live in it. They claim that the light that shines in the darkness can be trusted more than the darkness itself, and that a little bit of light can dispel a lot of darkness. This shift takes place through being made holy, through God's continuous redemptive act in your life. This shift turns us from a passive receiver of grace to an active vessel of grace. From the person who is met by Jesus to the person who follows along and feeds all people instead of just themselves. When the man asked Jesus what the greatest commandment is, Jesus says the Shema, Shema Yisrael. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with your heart and your soul and your mind. And the second, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. This love of God and love of neighbor displaces sin and pours outward in action and prayer. And displaces like a bathtub. Like when you get in the bathtub, if it's full and the water splashes up. And that's what happens to your body when grace enters you. The sin comes out. It's like if you have a jar full of water and you pour oil in it. And the oil displaces the water and eventually the water flows out. But grace is not just limited. The grace God gives us cannot be just contained in us. It overflows into other people. As it says in Psalm 23, my cup runneth over. Psalm 23 itself describes the path of discipleship. If you remember, it describes the path from prevenient grace. The Lord leads me beside still waters. To justifying grace, the Lord restores my soul to sanctifying grace. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. That is sanctification. God is with us, and we are walking. We are not standing still. God is with us, and we are walking. And we may be in the valley of the shadow of death, But we do not fear because God is with us. Jesus calls us, follow me. It is simple and radical to the root. Do you wish to answer God's call? Do you wish to empty yourself of all but love, as Charles Wesley says? I think about again about the vase. If you empty, what would it be like to empty yourself of all but love? That all was inside of you. The only thing left inside of you was love. That is what being made holy is. Do you wish to move from a consumer of God to a vessel of mercy? As Henry Nouwen again says, the question is not how am I to find God, but how am I to be found in God? The question is not how am I to know God, but how am I to be known by God? Let us each ready ourselves to be known by God. We all are on different paths with different lives and challenges. Some of us may have had a powerful experience of God's love. Others may be yearning for just such a grace. Lay down your nets. Lay down your burdens. Lay down your sorrows. Jesus is calling. Let us follow him. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.